What's up? What's up? Welcome to another episode of All Over Voiceover with Kip VH. I'm your host, Kip VH. Welcome to the show. I am thrilled to welcome a wonderful voice performer, actress, host of things, violinist.
Oh my gosh.
Right? The lovely, the talented Erica Ishii. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
You're welcome. I saw the violin bit, just to share. I saw you perform with We Talk Funny at Flappers at the beginning of the month. And your piece was amazing.
Oh, thank you so much. That was such a rush. I always forget how much I love live performance because, you know, I mean, all of us sort of grew up in it.
Yeah.
I'd say most voiceover people came from stage.
I think so.
Or at least music.
Yeah.
And so at the performance, it was all Abrams people. So our talent agency had a bunch of us performing in a showcase, and everybody had some sort of musical component to their act, like comedy.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. Everybody's so insanely talented in areas outside of just being on mic. And it was so fun for me because, actually, shout out to my collaborators on that piece, Joe Starr of Screen Junkies. He does Honest Trailers.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Sax Carr, who's my manager and one of my best friends in the world. And so we've all been writing together comedy since our UCB days.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so we did Tournament of Nerds, which is this
show where
eight comedians represent eight pop culture characters and have essentially a roast battle. So we've been sort of writing together on that and other sketches and sort of weird bits for like 7-8 years now or something. And
that's
so
amazing.
We came up with this bit of it's me that I've learned the violin in honor of Game of Thrones. Only the last season happened, so I start interrupting myself during the playing, and I just get madder and madder and more upset and just sort of break down. And it was such a joy to get to do, and I was so surprised that everybody else must have been as raw and reactive to it as I was. Because, look, I love Game of Thrones, and it is a groundbreaking television series, but I think we were all a little disappointed with how it all ended up. And, you know, it's fun to find the humor in it, and it is not punching down because, come on, they still want all the Emmys.
Right, and there was nothing about it that felt like punching down at all. What I really loved about the piece was that it was so connected to your emotional life and your expectation and what you were holding up and what they failed to deliver.
Right.
And like, I don't know, it was a delightful piece and super fun.
But,
it's
funny. I think all voiceover folks, I don't want to generalize, but every voiceover person that I've talked to has a musical background. For me, it was violin, musical theater, and then some sort of performance at an improv experience. I got to say, you know, out of everything that I've learned in voiceover, I think my improv training has helped the most to just be able to make a strong decision and stick with it and just take it all the way, baby.
Well, let me go all the way back. Like, where are you from?
Oh, L.A. Mm. So I'm one of the few L.A. natives, and I did the whole child acting thing.
Did you really?
I did. So my parents were both in the film industry, focus puller for camera op, and my mom was an editor. And so they saw that I was extremely outgoing, and I just had all this excess energy, and I was so extroverted. So they thought maybe I'd enjoy being on camera. And so they put me into acting classes and, you know, took me to auditions. And so I had this little career when I was younger of I was in a lot of Barbie commercials.
I was
in an episode of Full House.
Oh, man.
The Play's the Thing. I think season 6, 9, something like that. And, you know, I really enjoyed performance growing up. And so I did. I was a very, very awkward teen. Like, I braces, glasses, you know, sort of gangly. So I sort of transitioned to theater. And I did a lot of musical theater and stage productions in community. And I feel so lucky that I grew up with parents that were very supportive of that while not being pushy.
Yeah.
So,
that's great.
You know, I've spent my whole life around just performance, and now doing voiceover. Well, how did predominantly, you, it's just such a gift.
I'm sorry to totally yeah, cut you off.
Skip, we're skipping around here. We're skipping around.
I'm happy to skip around.
Jump
I love
in whenever you can.
Skip around is awesome. How did you find yourself? Well, where did you did you go to college here? Did you finish high school?
Yeah, I stopped acting, and I went to CSUN and then UCLA.
Okay.
Majored in mass media communications. Huh. Did a lot of violin on the side. I decided that wasn't what I wanted to be for my career,
mm-hmm.
just because like it's how my soul sings, but it wasn't the performance that I chose to focus on the most.
Yeah.
So I stopped for college, and then after that, I went to the Strasberg Institute.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
The
method.
One, like, in
yeah,
West Hollywood?
The one right there in Fairfax.
Really?
Yeah. It was so fun, and I learned a lot from it, but also I just don't – let me tell you a little something about method acting, and I'm telling everybody this now because it is not method acting's fault when people are abusive to their castmates, because what I took from it was how to sit in a chair and relax and make funny noises or sort of like animal exercises.
Yeah.
But, you know, taking care of your mental health and being kind and considerate to the people you work with is also very important. And
yeah.
I don't remember anything saying anything otherwise at the method school. So, you know.
That's a really important PSA and incredibly true, because it's like people will blame their training for their bad behavior.
Yeah.
And it's absolute nonsense.
I don't care for that. It's not nice.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, honestly, you will get so much further in this industry being kind to other people than
yeah.
being like, an actor, I guess. method school was really wonderful. It's just very honest. There's something very honest. It's about honesty,
yeah.
honestly. And then I also did UCB.
Awesome.
Which was incredible. It just helps you think on your feet
yeah.
and make strong choices. And it kind of introduced me to this network of people who we all kind of came up together. There's
yeah.
there's folks in, as I said, Honest Trailers is getting nominated for Emmy Awards, or a lot of people are writing on, you know, Thundercats or Powerpuff Girls, or there's folks guest starring or starring in so many comedy shows around town now.
Yeah.
It's so great to, you know, stick with your tribe.
Yeah.
To see how your peers kind of level up.
Yeah.
It's funny because I was pursuing on-camera acting, and I wasn't thrilled with all and not making as much headway in what I wanted to be doing. A lot of the roles were very limited.
Mm.
You're very much limited by the way you look, and it was even kind of worse back then.
Yeah.
So I'd always wanted to do – I loved cartoons growing up, you know. It's interesting if you ask, like, what cartoons do you grow up with somebody? It really is – you know, you got to age yourself.
Well, completely.
Yeah.
What cartoons did you grow up with? Not to make you age
God.
Yourself.
Well, oh,
listen,
God.
Trust me. I got you beat.
Yeah,
I got you
okay.
beat. I mean, I grew up with Tom and Jerry, 1940s, Uncensored, Looney Tunes, Tex Avery.
Oh, gosh.
Yogi Bear was
– well, they showed all of those, but on sort of like the throwback blonde
right.
for us.
So we didn't get throwback. It was just like, this
exactly.
is it. This
so,
is Gilligan's
yeah,
Island.
Like ton of sort of like the Hanna-Barbera throwback stuff. I'd say a lot of my formative cartoons were, I don't know, Batman the Animated Series, and that
yeah.
era in the 90s was just incredible.
Oh my
and
God.
One of my huge regrets is not getting into voiceover before Andrea Romano retired.
Yeah.
She cast all of those Warner Brothers cartoons and directed, and she was just, I think about the performances and how much they must have, they just really stuck with me.
Yeah.
Those, the Nickelodeon cartoons, you know, Rugrats and
yeah.
and I think Doug, when Doug moved over, what was it, ABC? And I think a little before that was Ninja Turtles, but I don't remember that as much. I was very, very young for that.
Yeah.
And also anime. Anime, too, was huge for me. I always sort of talk about how growing up Japanese-American was somewhat tough here, and the first cultural ambassador to America, in my mind, was anime. So
yeah.
Sailor Moon and Dragon Ball and Pokemon, were all, you know, so huge for me growing up. And yeah, so those, I always loved cartoons and I always wanted that. But then video games. I realized video games was where so much exciting acting was happening. And I'd grown up with, you know, sort of the traditional console systems and PC gaming. But I think it was The Last of Us that really sort of sold me on it. And I realized how I was like, whoa, there are performances in here that are more grounded and real than I've ever seen in anything ever, ever.
Yeah.
So I decided I wanted to pursue voice acting. And so I, you know, sort of started taking classes to see if it was right for me. And it's funny because I think a lot of my friends around the time, you know, that I sort of knew through UCB people or sort of tangentially in this sort of geek cosplay scene in LA were already in their own right very accomplished voice actors.
Really?
And and so, you know, I never really wanted to ask anybody for help or, you know, it seemed like I was, you know, trying to, you know.
I know.
You never want to ask for help or seem like you're imposing upon a friendship.
Right.
And so I really didn't, you know, sort of go that way. But, you know, I was very fortunate in that a lot of my friends that did, because sort of simultaneous to that, I started doing the hosting thing at Geek & Sundry. And so a lot of the folks in that world either, you know, I met a lot of game developers that were like, oh, you do voiceover, you, like, hand me your demo. And on one hand, you know, I'm like, wow, I just really got super lucky. But on the other hand, I did have a demo to hand them, which is super important. And, you know, Rob Paulson, who's such a legend, like, he was doing a podcast out of the same studio as me. And he's like,
come on
my podcast, like, talking tunes. And, you know, I'll listen to your demo. And I just will always be so intensely grateful for that, you know. And he told me, you know, in some ways to kind of make me feel better about all of this, was that success is where luck meets preparation. Hmm. And you know, I have to admit that, you know, and on some level, even though I really was in the right place at the right time for a lot of these things, that I still had my training to fall back on, or I still had, you know, a demo to hand people or a resume, you know, that had credits on it. And, you know, it's hard. It's hard getting started. But, you know, over this sort of ramp of maybe 4 years, and then within the last year of finally deciding to go for it and get an agent. And it's just, you just kind of do what you can when you can and just be prepared for everything.
That's it. It's fascinating how people, it's the question I hear most frequently from folks is like, how do I get into it? How do I get started? And it's like, what do you have? What skills do you already have? Can you act? And it seems like such a fundamental baseline thing, you know?
It's funny because, you know, there are so many other jobs that, you know, you look at that and you're like, oh, well, I obviously couldn't be a doctor right off the bat. That takes a lot of school and, you know, training and certifications. And for voiceover, it's like everybody has a voice and everybody has feelings. So, you know, everybody should be able to use their feelings to make voices for characters, right? And you don't, there's oftentimes, and there are some people that can just do it, that are just, they don't need training, they don't need anything, they're just talented. But more often than not, it's that, you know, you just need to kind of hunker down and do a lot of legwork for things. And it's so interesting to me because now I feel like I'm part of a generation, and, you know, even the generation under me for voice actors, of people that specifically wanted to get into acting for voice acting. Or specifically pursuing it, because I think a lot of the generation before me was, you know, training for stage or on camera or other things, and then realized that they could fall into this and that they loved it and that they were really good at it. But now I think it's interesting to see this generation of people who grew up with video games and animation and are like, oh, yeah, no, that's what I want to do. And if on camera happens, it happens.
That's so interesting.
That's
so true.
But I think I look at a lot of the people who I admire most in this industry because, you know, and they're a generation ahead of me or even my peers, and they all have, yes, this eclectic training of, you know, music and stage and, you know, on camera and all of this stuff that sort of slots into voiceover somehow. Mm. You know, because there's just so much that actually goes into it that, you know, I never would have really thought of, you know, just watching cartoons. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, is it? It's like almost sometimes I think of it as, you know, and definitely for mocap, but it's like black box theater.
Oh, my God.
Black box theater, for those not familiar, are, you know, it's a theater in which there's nothing. You get nothing. You get a black box to pretend to be your right. chair or your stool or your bed or everything. And you just have to create everything in your head. And so for voiceover, you know, when you're standing in a mic, you're like, oh, how far away am I from this person that doesn't exist in this room?
Right.
Is it snowing? You know, what's just happened before this? What's just about to happen?
Yeah.
And there's all these factors that you really have to, you know, condense into a single performance.
Yeah.
And it's a lot.
All those essential aspects that a full script will give you that you don't get.
Mm-hmm.
More often than not.
Yeah, that's the thing, is it depends on what you get too. Sometimes you're lucky if you know what you look like.
Oh my God. Yeah. I had a thing recently where I was told you're gonna be doing this dialect, and I got to the session, they're like, that was not correct information.
Right.
You're going to be doing this dialect,
oh,
even
no.
though you prepared to do
That's
this dialect.
That's the nightmare. The nightmare is you show up to a session, and they're like, you need an accent.
Oh, yeah.
You're like, oh, okay.
Oh, and which accent would that be?
Yeah,
I hope it's a native accent to me.
I know. Yeah.
And unfortunately, I was able to pivot and
right.
move on and all that other stuff.
Yes.
But it was still like, you know, but and as much as it's kind of actor's nightmare.
It's also, I love it.
Right?
I love it so much. I love all of that. And that's the thing is that, you know, I'm such a theater kid and I loved all of that. And I miss theater in that regard so much. And honestly, it is so hard to make a living in theater. Just so props to everybody who does.
Yeah.
And in Los Angeles especially, it is not really a viable career option. So to get to do all of those things, but, you know, still, you know.
In a mocap volume where you get to create. And I mean, yes to everything that you've
yes.
been saying. And like the improv training to, in particular, for motion capture, like, I mean, I've been doing stuff with mocap vaults, and I've
oh, awesome! I'm actually going to take a class this weekend.
Yeah. Oh, are you really?
Yeah.
Terry Notary's thing?
I'm not sure who it is. Actually,
okay.
But so another friend actually set it up. But yeah,
awesome.
I've done a ton of mocap training, but haven't really even got many mocap auditions yet.
Yeah.
I know they pull a lot from on camera folks because of the memorization aspect and
yeah.
what have you. But yeah, you've done.
I did one motion capture job back in 2004. I was in Midnight Club 3 Dub Edition.
Whoa.
I was the Detroit boss for Rockstar Games.
It must have been so different back then.
It was different and not.
Okay.
Amazing director named Naveed Kandasari, who's gone on to develop. He did this amazing like indie game called about the Iranian Revolution. It's called 1979.
Oh yeah, I played that at IndieCade.
Oh, do you really?
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Naveed's game, and he directed a ton of cinematics for Rockstar in New York.
Yeah, yeah.
And but like I had a multimedia producer background. I was a multimedia producer producing interactive training before I started performing.
Oh, no kidding.
So, like, I know all about, like, Lightwave and After Effects and
oh,
all that kind of stuff. So,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
Consequently, I'm like, oh, tech to record myself? Easy peasy.
Wow.
I got this. So, Audacity and da-da-da. So, like, I know how to edit and I know how to work my way around Photoshop and blah, blah, blah.
Oh, that's nice.
Enough to be dangerous, enough to cut, enough to make a self-tape easy.
Oh, that's
so
good.
Like that.
Self-tapes!
I'm telling you. And like self-tapes for mocap on top of it.
Wow.
Like even if it's just the skill, just the background of stage training to be able to learn something from memory and then put it up in a day.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Or just the on-camera experience that we get, even for, you know, for a commercial, even a 30-second spot.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. A 30-second spot is, you know, you got to make a choice and
uh-huh.
stick with it and, like, just lean into it. And,
right.
Yeah, there's so much. Yeah, improv keeps coming up today, but, yeah, it is really invaluable as a skill. I mean, even in life, honestly, I feel like conversations got better. And an important thing improv teaches you is listening, too.
Yeah.
Listening and reacting.
Yeah.
Just so important for this.
I think it's crucial. And it's made every relationship in my life better.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I'm Second City, so I came up.
Oh, heck yes.
I came up Second City in Detroit starting in 1998 and never looked back.
Oh,
and
wow.
Still teach and direct over at Second City in Hollywood.
Oh, wait, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, super cool.
So improv is – I've been doing improv longer than I've been a professional actor.
Wow.
So I guess it started – but then I started in college, so about the same. But, like – but how that informs, you know, and even like an audition – well, like – talking about like audition life and
audition life. That's something that they don't really tell you, like that you don't really, a lot of people don't see, is that even though, you know, your career is voiceover, you only spend like, well, for most of it, I'm sure, unless when you get really successful, that's not necessarily the case, but like you spend most of it like not in the booth or actually working. You spend most of it auditioning.
Yes.
No.
100%.
So, yeah, get used to that.
Yeah.
Get used to a lot of getting, like, you know, the idea of getting ghosted where you know, like, you put your heart out there and then you just don't hear anything. Imagine that, but maybe 5 times a day.
Always.
So, you know.
It's a constant state of being.
It's true. We have abandonment issues and stuff. And, you know, do you blame us? It's fun. It's also fun too because it keeps you sharp.
Do you? How's your process of releasing auditions that you really want to book?
Oh gosh,
in yourself. You know what I mean?
It's like, so hard. I'm still at that point where everyone is precious. You know, like and you're not. But you're supposed to just send it out,
Right.
Not you just throw it into the ether and you don't care about it. But I care too much, Kiff.
Yeah,
I care too much.
But that means you're doing good work.
Yeah, it's true. And that's the thing is my process for it is to like try and not psych myself out to just do it because I'm still you know and honestly. At Abrams, they have a booth there and a booth director, and you can go in and do it. And I much prefer that because when I'm on my own, I will do it. And I'm like, I can go and, like, tweak this. And I just, like, you know, go bit by bit and just get in my head. And, like, but oftentimes it's just, like, the first thing you throw out there and you just have to do it. You have to commit and do it and trust that your first instinct is right as opposed to going back and driving yourself crazy because that is what happens sometimes on my own. So I, you know, if it's something I really want, I just go in so that I can have somebody mostly to tell me you're done.
Yeah. You're good. It was great. I liked you're in the ballpark.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I know that my first read in my closet is going to be ballpark and it's going to probably be 75% to 80%, but in my head, but it may be a reality. It might be 95%.
Yeah. I don't know. You don't know. That's the thing.
Right.
Is you just don't know. And it's, you don't. It's interesting, too, when, you know, I'm starting to get to this point where, you know, I've done a lot of auditions for a place. And then I hear, like, through the grapevine, like, oh, you know, they've been hearing your auditions. They really like you. I'm like, really? I had no idea that they even knew who I was because I've been, like, submitted so many auditions and I just hear nothing. So I don't know. But you don't know. You don't know anything about it. So just. Don't trust yourself on it. Just go. Just go and do it.
Yeah.
And you know, it's funny because I do remember a time. I'm very privileged in that I have an agency, and that they send me all these amazing things, and that they trust me with things, and that you know if they think I'm even a little right for it, they'll send it to me. But I remember a time not very long ago in which I would get one audition maybe like in a month. Maybe, because I was getting them on my own or, you know, they came through the grapevine or just through studios that I knew. And, you know, so it's – I have to remember now, that there's just, like, the majority of things I'm not going to book. So to just kind of just do it.
What was your process from going – just because I've had all – I'm teaching right now and a lot of people are getting to this place. I'm teaching for accountants and accountants and like
– Oh, nice. Nice.
VO, you know, intro for actors and I'm getting ready to start teaching animation.
Oh,
like,
nice.
Yeah, a whole bunch of stuff, which is awesome. But like it is that moment, especially with people who are onboarding into it. And, you know, people come to VO at all ages, right?
Oh,
so,
yeah.
So, like,
yeah.
Trying to figure out, like, so I'm curious, what was your journey of going from an unrepresented actor, hustling opportunities for yourselves, making that choice of saying, this is something I want to pursue, pursuing it to getting to a place where now you're repped and they're sending you what you want. What was that onboarding process for you?
Yeah, that's the thing is that I decided, I was like, okay, I'm going to do it. So I sought out a coach. And so I had a coach and, you know, I just did that. And then I think what really kind of helped the most, though, was – you know, being, I mean, as I said, I feel like I snuck in the back door and I got lucky. It's just that, so Sissy Jones, who, I mean, Delilah and Firewatch, BAFTA award winning. Yeah, actress.
Yeah.
Sissy Jones.
Oh my God, The Walking Dead.
She's just remarkable. And I was a fan of her work. And, but she, you know, my friend Anthony Tedesco, he invited me to her workout group. So actor workout groups are when, you know, a lot of actors, most of the time they're working, will just bring in whatever scripts they're working on and just kind of work out together and give each other notes. And with her, and I think Kay Bess was in the group, and Larissa Gallagher, and Josie Ja, all of these people who are just incredibly talented. And I was this newbie, but they were like, no, like, you're up here, like, come work out with us on this. And just having other people and, like, hearing different reads, what they're supposed to sound like, what they're shooting for, what's out there. And I wasn't really getting auditions then, so I just would grab copy wherever. That really helped both with performance and honestly with sort of confidence levels. And all of the folks in that group were incredible. And I miss that group because we don't have time for it anymore. but that was big. And then also the fact that a lot of my friends who are voice actors or directors or, you know, in some way had the capacity to sort of extend a hand did. Mm-hmm. They did. And so they would say, like, hand me your demo. I'll put you in this pool. A lot of times it's very rarely like, oh, I will just cast you in this thing.
Yeah.
You know, it was a lot of, you know, oh, like, I, you know, there's a studio and they're always looking for actors to audition.
Yeah.
So I'll put you in that pool. And then, you know, auditioning for a while in that pool before suddenly something popped.
Yeah.
And, you know, I came in around the time of the union strikes, and I was SAG, so I couldn't work in a lot of regards, you know. So I think it slowed down progress in a lot of ways, I think. But I didn't, again, like, solidarity with your people, with your peers, like, do not, you know, cross the line in that way. Some things, on to be honest with you, some lines are kind of fuzzy. A lot of folks still work non-union and stuff. There are certain lines, you know, certain respect and courtesy for your fellow performers that, you know, I wasn't willing to cross. So that, I think, was an interesting time. And then, just it all kind of came little by little and just snowballed, you know?
Yeah.
Until finally, you know, I was starting to book union work on my own. Just through friends or through, like, projects that friends would invite me onto, because they knew that they could work. They liked working with me. Thank you, friends. You know who you are. and then, you know, eventually on one of those union projects, somebody was like, "Oh, you don't have an agent? Like, let me introduce you to mine." And then
they'll handle this deal.
And then another friend was like, "Oh, well, I hear you're looking for agents. Like, why don't you talk to mine?" And so I actually got to shop around. Honestly, Kif, I'd had bad experiences with on-camera agents before. And the prospect of getting to choose my agent, you know, and top agencies, too, in town, was just overwhelming for me. And it took me a while to decide, but then I did. And I'm so glad. I love Abrams so, so much.
Awesome.
I trust them. I'm not scared to go in and talk to them, and that sounds like a no-brainer, but, you know, here
it's
in this town,
thing.
It's a thing.
I totally agree. I have that same relationship with CESD, where it was just like, I'm not going to go in there and talk about anything, but I can.
I know.
And like, I love talking about movies with Sumit and like joking around with Bo and like and celebrating with people when you book stuff. Like they're so genuinely excited and get emotional with you. Like it's the greatest feeling to have that trust.
It's wild. I've never had a team before, and I certainly didn't have folks that were working as hard for me as I was trying to work for them. You know, it was a really, really gradual process. And I think, honestly, you know, advice for people that are sort of in that process, they're taking classes, which is great. You know, like having the demo is great. And, you know, honestly, it can be a huge investment of money and time. But, you know, if you're going to go for it, like just really you should, you have to go 100%.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you'll just never know. And I think that sort of prospect of just like having everything be ready. And there are times where because I really want to sort of do the same and extend a handout to anybody else who, you know, is, you know, looking for it or who's ready for it, rather, you know.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'll ask like, hey, can you give me your demo or something? And I'll just never get a response. Or, you know, like try taking a class and they're like, nah, I don't really like classes.
Right. There's that feeling of like, you know how hard it is to get a foot in a door. And if someone reaches out and gives you that opportunity and they don't take it.
Yeah.
That happened to me in Detroit with a guy of like, I'll walk you into my talent agency.
Whoa.
And I did. And he was like, oh, great. And then he never returned their phone calls.
Whoa.
And I was like.
Yeah.
Dude.
And again, it's I'm always going to be cognizant of my privilege in that, you know, I had the money to cut a demo. I had the money for classes. You know, I had the time, you know, not having a day job or having, you know, sort of performing work that was flexible to, you know, be able to go to auditions or to, you know. So it's I'm very privileged in that regard. But there, even in the days when I wasn't, when I was still like working catering all the time, you know, like having a network and still like submitting myself for different things, or you know, trying to like save up for a demo, you know, because that was my priority. I think just being prepared is what it is, and you know, keeping in touch with your peers too. You know?
That's huge. You have this group of folks who are adjacent artists who have got so many different skill sets, who are connected in so many different ways, and it's
right. And you can support each other
completely.
And you know, I'm always, as I kind of alluded to earlier, I'm always terrified of people thinking I'm using them for anything. Mm-hmm. I never want to take a friendship or a relationship for granted, or you know, be a user. But that being said, I think about, you know, or people have told me too, like what would happen if the situation was reversed? Mm-hmm. You know, like do I feel like, you know, if I had a friend that was totally ready, had a demo and, you know, just like was working hard, taking classes, like 100% I would walk them in to my agent, you know?
Right.
And I have. So, you know, don't be scared to, I guess, ask for something, because I was scared for a long time. But if you feel that you are doing the work and that you're, you know, you have a lot to offer, it's okay too to sort of reach out, I think.
And people make assumptions about how much you, what, not necessarily even what you might want, but how much you got going on or what you're doing, or based
on. It's
easy
to look super busy on social media and then in reality just be really wanting work.
Right.
And there's, it's such a balance. You know, it's funny because. You know, I sort of came up in the digital space too, you know, because simultaneous to all of the sort of little gigs that I was booking and the classes that I was taking, I was also working with Geek & Sundry and doing hosting, you know, all over so the digital space. And you learn to, you know, I hate to have to say this, but you do have to sort of market yourself.
Yeah.
Or at least to consider, are there casting agents and peers of mine that are following my social media account? And I'm not saying censor yourself or, you know, not be honest or anything, but to, like, you know, don't, you know, really, you know, poop on, you know, other professionals or other, and it is remarkable to me. I still see people, you know, say very rude things about like companies or people that they're hoping to work with, and you know, I still feel like I am very true to myself in my social media. What you see is what you get. You know, I still feel things. I'm honest about my flaws and shortcomings and sad feelings. But at the same time, too, I am cognizant that, you know, it's not a private space anymore. A lot of times we still think of social media as a private space, but it isn't. Like, how would you feel if you knew that, you know, people that you looked up to were reading what you wrote?
Yeah.
So, you know, it is important to figure out, you're sort of who you are publicly.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's funny because I'm always hesitant to make all these sort of grand statements and generalizations because nobody's journey is the same.
Yeah.
I mean, if you talk to anybody in this industry, everybody got into it a different way or has sort of different stories.
Right.
And so, you know, there's no wrong way to do it.
Right.
But there are some little sort of life hacks that you can learn along the way to make it easier.
Yeah. That's so true. That's so true. Well, let me ask you this question. How do you, diving into process.
Yes.
How do you approach a piece of copy? Let's say it's a character, an animated character for a pilot for a show, and it explodes in your mind, this idea of like, oh my God, this character is, I want to play this character.
Gosh, you know what? Breaking down a script is so, it has to kind of become second nature because it has to, because like when you show up in the booth, you know, most of the time you've not seen the script beforehand.
Yeah.
And you'll kind of know what your character is from your audition and stuff, but who knows? Like sometimes you just get called into a job and you don't know anything.
Right.
But yeah, for breaking down copy, it's so important to know your archetypes, honestly. You know, they'll ask for, because most of the time they'll at least give you sort of a basic of what the character is or what they're looking for. And so I book mostly in video games. You know, that's – video games is sort of like – I came up through the video game ranks and, you know, that's where I'm booking the most now. Video games, it's very easy to know your type. Like, who do I play? I play a lot of sort of like tough military chicks, sassy teens, occasionally young boys. Uh-huh. I don't do a lot of sort of like – I rarely get cast as sort of the ethereal sort of elf queen unless she's like – a ruler, you know?
And a warrior.
A warrior
elf,
you know?
Queen, yes.
You know your archetypes, what you can feasibly play, know what they're looking for. And then also, I mean, knowing what they ask for and what the archetype is also helps you if you suddenly see something that's different, making the choice that is not the archetype or a spin on it or, you know, just knowing what the character is the most important, I think. And then everything gets easy after that because it's like you kind of click into that headspace and then every line that you read, you're like, oh, this is how they would say this or this is the tone. And then also just making sure that, you have a definitive point of view.
Hmm.
Because sometimes I'll even catch myself doing this too, is you like read down a line, especially for video games and sometimes for animation, you don't get a full script. You just get a bunch of lines, kind of call out lines they're called.
Yeah.
And it's easy to kind of make it one note, but you have to sort of find a point of view for everything. Like everything you say has to have some sort of purpose. Like when we're talking now or any time you talk, you have something that you're trying to say or do or some sort of different way of saying things. So I think primary is character and secondary is sort of intention in the lines because, you know, one will inform the other.
Yeah. Well, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
I've never thought of that idea as your point of view. For a character, let's say, for example, it's a character scene and it's maybe a 3-page side and it's like, you know, dialogue rather than a bunch of Excel spreadsheet lines, single lines. But the idea of a character changing the way the character is saying what he or she is saying because they've already said it a certain way earlier.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily a strong point of view, but something to think on when you're when you're listening back.
Well, just something to catch. It's not like you should deliberately be like, well, they were angry here, so they need to be sad here.
Right.
But more just like, am I only just angry in this whole three pages? Or like, and even when you're angry, you don't like, there are quiet moments when you get angry. You know, you just get really angry and stuff. And there are sometimes shouting moments, but then, and because things go, I don't know, it's just, it's, you have to sort of think about the roller coaster of emotions, I guess.
Well,
too,
like,
you know?
Just unpacking the idea of anger, like, you're saying, like, you can be outraged.
Yes.
You could be really hurt becoming from that space. It could be a laughing, mocking anger of, like, that's baffling that you think that.
Wow.
Right? There's a universe inside of each single emotion.
Yes.
You know?
There's all these different colors that, you got to kind of find. And it's not even just, like, as I said, it's not even intentionally sort of like putting those colors there, but just like seeing, finding the different intentions. Like why would you say this something? Why are you saying this?
Yeah.
And you know, again, it's not a perfect science. I catch myself like, you know, but still I think that is what has helped the most in terms of breaking down a script because the easiest ones to do, the easiest auditions are the ones in which I take a look at the character and say, I know who this is. You know, whether it's a weird sort of offbeat choice from what they asked for or, you know, just like sort of dead on that. But just knowing who the character is, I think, is just the most important thing.
That's kind of super comforting.
Yeah.
Like I literally had an audition today where I looked at the character image and was like, I know who that is.
Yeah.
And then I did it, and then I wanted to make it harder than it was.
Oh, no.
But, like, every time I would redo it, I didn't change a thing. Like, I did it maybe four or five times and was like,
I just wanted to be this person.
The character won't let me make it anything other than what I'm making it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always a magical moment when you can do that and you make a strong choice. And the thing is, and it happens sometimes, is you make this choice and either you don't hear anything or you get close, but you're like, you know, I went with this one, I went with it. And like, if they didn't pick me, it's because they didn't like that character choice, you know, and that's okay. That's okay. You know, it's not that I wasn't good at it. It's just that I made this choice and they were like, well, it's this other thing. This is the way we see this character. And you can't split the middle and win. You know, you just can't.
That's,
you know,
that's so
and
true.
I, you know, I have tried to do that before. And it's just, it makes the read harder and it's hard to grasp. And it's not a strong enough choice. So, you know.
One of the ideas that's helped me a lot with the rejection aspect of this stuff is denying that it's rejection.
Like,
I'm not selected. And that has helped a great deal. Like, you know, I was talking to Candy Milo about this. I'm like, there's a thing of Jolly Ranchers on the desk. And there's a cherry one and there's a grape one and an apple. I'm going to go with grape. But I didn't reject the red one.
Right.
Right? I just selected grape because I want a grape right now. And the show wants a grape. And that. The rejection is if I put it in and spit it out.
That being said, like being recast and stuff is a very difficult thing and a real thing. But they say, you know, you're not anyone until you have replaced somebody and also been recast. Mm. So.
Yes.
Yeah. It happens. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I was sort of joking before about abandonment issues and rejection. But, you know, it's just, I'm so thrilled and honored that I even get to read for a lot of these things that it just kind of, you know, there are very few jobs where I was just like, oh, I really wish that I'd gotten that, because most of the time you hear it and you're like, oh no, that was the right choice.
That was for them. You go back and hear your audition and go, I don't know why I was so excited about the possibility of even getting a callback.
Yeah.
That was never going to happen.
Yeah. And you know, and another thing too is that you said, you know, about the rejection, you know, I'm into grape right now, but not the red one. It's a lot of times, or so I hear, they'll hear if you make a strong choice like that and they don't want it for that character, they'll still be like, oh, that's a really interesting take, and I can see this person knows how to make a strong choice. Like, yeah. Let's keep them in mind for another thing.
Yeah.
Which has – oh, yeah, that's actually sort of happened to me before, you know.
Awesome.
I don't know. It's funny. There are sort of comforting things to hear at every stage of the journey, right, you know?
Totally.
Like, both when you're starting out, it's like, you know, it's okay. It seems so daunting and so far away, but – you know, just dip your toe in and see if you like it and go for it. All the way to, you know, like, look, you got to callbacks and you didn't make it, but that's okay because that means that, you know, you had something special that got chosen out of hundreds of different tapes, you know?
And on camera and commercial, like, your job is to get the callback. That's all.
Yeah.
Just, like, especially commercial, if you're going to go to, you know, 200 South and you're auditioning against 200 people and you've already, I love that sign over at ASG. Casting. It's like, you know, congratulations, you've already made it to our top 40.
Oh, wow.
So don't blow it by being a dick.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's essentially
it.
It's like, yeah, okay, well, that's.
You book the studio, is what they say.
Win the room, yeah.
You win the room.
That's
book
it.
The room.
That's exactly right.
And yeah, it's very exciting. And I'm just so excited too about this next year upcoming. For me and for friends, you know, I feel like it's such a wonderful time to be a performer and such an incredible time to be a geek.
Oh, my God.
I mean.
Can you talk about that a little bit? Like,
yeah,
the space that you occupy in the industry at large is a really fascinating space.
Yeah, it's funny because I feel like there's a lot less distance between fan and creator now.
Yeah.
Both in sometimes not as positive aspects in that, you know, there's a direct line and we see everything that people say. But, you know, I have found it overwhelmingly positive. Mm. Again, I'm very privileged in that regard. But, you know, to grow up as such a fan of all these properties, as I said, Sailor Moon was one of the first things, you know, suddenly it was kind of okay to be Japanese, you know.
Wow.
And I got to do voices in the Sailor Moon dub, you know, which is just unbelievable. I was Junjun from the Dead Moon Circus arc, and I just remember seeing that when I was little, and I couldn't believe it. And Gundam as well.
Oh,
you know,
my God.
I was the lead in the Gundam narrative film.
Dude.
And I just remember, like, playing with my friends' Gundams growing up, you know? And it's so remarkable to be part of a lot of these things that I just – that informed me.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, I can't – you know, statistically speaking – we are all going to be part of a Star War, you know?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, there's just so much now. There's the TV. There's animated. There's,
oh, my God. The video,
you know, video
game
games.
World.
There's, you know, the movies. And you know, like, just that possibility that I'm going to one day be able to hand a thing to my mom and be like, Mom, I'm in a Star Wars. Like, she loves Star Wars. She was one of the little side tangent about my mom and, you know, my supportive parents. They were geeks, you know. Like,
uh-huh.
she actually worked with Lucas and the boys back in the day. She went to an early pre-screening of Star Wars before it hit the public and stuff. And
she
knew how huge it was going to be. So she's been a fan literally before anybody. Like, the most hipsterest of hipster fans of Star Wars.
That's
awesome. Yeah, and so I take her to every time. I as in my capacity as press, you know, I still get to take her to the Star Wars premieres, you know, and which is incredible. And, you know, so to one day be like, I'm part of this is like, I really want that. And that's sort of one of the little bucket. Everybody's got their little bucket list, right?
It's an amazing.
What did you have a sort
I play Han Solo.
I know that.
But, like, so that, what's my bucket list to do?
Yeah, what's your bucket list? I mean.
It's, like.
Gosh.
I'm probably Yogi Bear or Dino Mutt.
Oh my gosh, it's so funny that you can say specifically. I'm like, yeah. Look, I'll be happy to be a stormtrooper, but you know,
I bet, once you play,
I want to be Han Solo, and you did.
Like, and I'm a voice at Disneyland. Like, I'm a pirate.
Right, for the auction. Oh my God.
Yeah. Hey, anchor now, you swabbies. What may I offer for these hardy hens? Each one an egg layer. And like, that's.
You don't even know. I love it. Gray is the moment.
Gray is the red. And that was me and Gray and Mark Grau in our recording studio, and we were in there for 20 minutes. And like, after like the eighth take, they were like, okay, hold on, we're going to put something together. And we looked at each other and we're like, it's over. Like the moment of anticipation and all that of like to get into the recording and then you do it and then you're like, now they're cutting it and now we might be out of here. And like how quick that went. But then the idea of this thing and then writing it for the first time with my daughter.
Oh, wow. I mean, that is so special.
Yeah.
It really is.
And it was something that Sherry, my wife, said to me was like, you know, she's like, it's weird how the idea. Sorry, I didn't go to get emotional about it, but I will.
It's when
you go before me, I can still visit you.
Oh.
Yeah. Right? Like, that's what that space is. That's what this idea of legacy gets to be for us and how these things and not just people who are close to us too, but like, I mean, generational or people who are inspired the way we were inspired by the people.
I don't want to sort of like think about it too hard or, you know, it feels kind of arrogant to think, but you know, yeah, I think about how much stories impacted my life, how much they do. I think that as humans, the most important thing that we can do and that we do is tell stories. It defines and, you know, says who we are.
Yeah.
And the fact that I get to tell stories, these stories that are so precious to other people, it really kind of blows my mind. And, like, occasionally I do. I stop and think and have a good cry about it, you know?
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. And I'm so excited about the stories that are being told now. And,
oh, my God.
Also, you know, I mean, honestly, I feel like I get to tell stories that were not sort of being told before, or that, you know, I get to play. I've gotten to be part of a lot of things. Like, you know, one of my sort of early game jobs was a dream daddy, a dad dating sim, which is, you know, I play Amanda, the daughter of the lead character who is like a queer man trying to date other queer men. And that's, I mean, it's the kind of game that I would have been obsessed with even if I hadn't been in it. But, like, getting to be part of telling that story and something that is so different, you know, was really important to me. And I feel like, yeah, I'm so excited about the stories that we're telling now. And I'm excited about the stories that are going to be inspired by all of this. And it sounds kind of – I feel kind of arrogant talking about it. But, yeah, like
– yeah. I hear you. Stories are important. And like, the crazy thing is we set out to do this and we are.
Yeah.
And like that.
And I feel like everybody should do that. If they want to tell stories, everybody should.
Yeah.
You know, the world needs stories. The world needs your stories.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter if it is in, like, if you get to play Han Solo or if you're sort of, you know, I follow some writers on Twitter that tweet out sort of lovely little snippets of story every day. And, you know, it just does a lot for me. You know, whatever medium your storytelling takes, like, the world needs it.
Yeah.
You should do it. You know, it doesn't even have to be a career. It could just be something for you. But
yeah,
in the end, it always really came back to me, to telling stories. I wanted to tell stories. One of my favorite one of my fictional heroes in life has always been Scheherazade in the Arabian Nights. And her story is that there was this king who was wronged by his wife, and so he had her executed, and then he declared that every day he would take a new wife and then execute her in the morning. Monstrous. Yeah. There's parts of the story that I do not care for the ending of, but Scheherazade was, a courtier's daughter, and so she'd been kept from marrying him for a long time until finally she said, no, I'm going to do it. And they got married, and that night she started to tell him a story. And she just entranced him with the storytelling. And halfway through she stopped and she said, it's late and, I have to be executed in the morning, so I guess we should get some sleep. And he said, oh, it's okay. Why don't we stay the execution? You can finish the story tomorrow night. And so they slept, they had the day, and then the next night she continued the story, and she told stories within stories within stories, and she didn't get to the end of it. And so he had to stay her execution for another day, and this happened for 1,001 nights. And at the end of it, she said, I have no more stories to tell. You can kill me now. And he had changed. Through the course of the storytelling, he had learned empathy and how to be, how to relate to humans and all of these, the importance of, love and stories. And so he decided to marry her for real that time, and there would be no more deaths in the kingdom. And that was a story that always kind of stuck with me, the idea of telling stories to change the world or to change. Sometimes if you change one person's mind, you change the world. And, I feel so lucky that I get to do it.
Me too.
Thanks, Kev.
Oh, my God. Dude, our time is coasting to us. So... My question for you is, how can people find you on, Instagram, Twitter, that kind of stuff? Where are you at?
I am at Erika Ishii on Twitter, E-R-I-K-A-I-S-H-I-I, and at The Erika Ishii on Instagram. I post a lot on there. I'm very active. I love interacting with folks because I've been very lucky and that our community is just very lovely. So,
well, you make it even more so.
Thank you. That's Thank very you so kind much. Of you, Kiff. This was so great.
This
Thanks
was amazing. Oh my God. You're welcome. yeah. Thank you so much for joining us for this marvelous episode. And there'll be more coming soon. Thank you so much. Peace.
Bye.
This has been All Over VoiceOver with Kiff VH. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please go to iTunes and give us a positive rating. It truly helps. Follow me on Twitter at KiffVH or on Instagram at KiffVH or on Vero at KiffVH. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you soon. Claim victory and depart the field.
Werewolf?
Yeah.
It's almost always the anomaly.
Yeah, it's an anomaly whenever there's somebody's like, wow, I heard this person was not very nice. And it's everyone's like, really? In VoiceOver?
That's not my experience.
I know. Yeah.
What's wrong with you? Who were you when you went into that room with Darren DePaul?
The industry's nicest man. Yeah. Oh, man. It's so great. Notice, look at people's faces when you bring up Darren. You're like, oh, yeah. I saw Darren DePaul. Their faces light up like it's Christmas. They're like, oh, Darren DePaul. Yeah. He's so great.
Oh, man. So I just adore him. He's awesome.
Truly good person. So talented. It's wild, too, how it's like the most talented people are just the awesome.